Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. Subscribe to SubChina's daily email newsletter to stay on top of the latest news from China, or download our new and improved smartphone app, or visit the website, subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. And while you are there, check out our new business news podcast, the Caixin Cynical Business Brief, for a weekly roundup of top stories from Caixin, China's authoritative source for business and financial news. I'm Kaiser Guo. I am coming to you from the Cynical South Studio in downtown Durham, North Carolina today. I am joined remotely from a converted moonshine still out in Goldcorn Holler in the backwoods outside Nashville, Tennessee, by amateur mule skinner Jeremy Goldcorn. Great people are, Jeremy.
Hey, y'all.
So today we are delighted to be joined by our good friend Tom Miller, whose book is he's touring in support of his book right now. Yeah, his latest excellent work, which is called China's Asian Dream. Longtime listeners are going to remember Tom from his last book, which was called China's Urban Billion, which was a of course, about urbanization. Tom is senior analyst at Gavikal Research, and he works with the estimable Arthur Kroeber and Andrew Batson. Tom, congrats on the book, which I devoured and really, really enjoyed. I actually thought it was like incredibly timing, dropping as did a couple of months ahead of the whole Belt and Road Forum thing in Beijing, because it's kind of a marvelous explanation of just what Belt and Road is all about. So, Tom, well, welcome to North Carolina first.
Thanks very much, Kaiser. It's great to be here.
And welcome back to Seneca.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely. Right. It's my first time down in the South, so it's all very exciting for me.
Right.
Well, you know, this is the real America. Welcome to it, Tom. one thing that really stands out about this book, and I think really makes it work, is that it's a combination of analysis and on-the-ground reporting. Can you tell us about what went into the reporting for this book?
Right. So I traveled to around a dozen countries and regions, I would say, including Yunnan and Xinjiang, places like that in China.
All on that generous advance that Zed gave you, right?
That's right. Or, you know, that £300 I got for writing the book. So, guys, you know, don't write a book to make money, okay?
For Paul French, perhaps.
The book has nothing to do with Paul.
Paul was angry.
I think Paul's fallen out with Zed because they're crap.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Anyway.
All right, just
We'll get on with... they're great. They're a fantastic publisher.
Let's just censor that from the podcast. That doesn't make any sense.
No, it's not.
No, let's not. No, seriously, they need to kick up the arse. Right, so shall I start again?
No. Keep going.
Right, so I traveled to around a dozen countries and regions for the book. So it took me about 18 months, 2 years of traveling. So I went to lots of funny little places like Kyrgyzstan, you know, Laos, Burma, Cambodia, Vietnam, Kazakhstan, Sri Lanka, India, among other places. So yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time on the ground talking to ordinary people, you know, sort of truckers, market traders, yes, taxi drivers, but also think tank people, government ministers, officials, monks, prostitutes, you name it, I spoke to everybody. So one of the most interesting places I went to was the Golden Triangle Special Economic Zone. So it's in the Golden Triangle, which is famous, of course, for its opium production. So this is where Laos, Burma, and Thailand meet, and it's where, you know, the Mekong River forms the border of those three countries. And there's a special economic zone on the Laos side of the river, but, you know, it's literally, I'd say, a decent drive if you play golf over the river to Burma and to Thailand. And as soon as you walk into this special economic zone, which is basically 100 square kilometers of land, which is being held by a kind of Dongbei businessman on a 99-year lease. So it's almost like a mini Chinese colony.
It's Macau and the Mekong,
right? It's cool, yeah. I'll get to that in a bit. But when you walk into this place and, you know, immediately the time on your phone switches forward an hour into Chinese time. So, you know, suddenly your phone is on China Mobile. Everyone is speaking Chinese. You know, you use renminbi is the only currency there. And at the center of this place, there's this big kind of golden dome and a glitzy casino inside. So it's known as Macau on the Mekong. But it's more than just a kind of gambling den. King's Romans is called,
yeah. King's Romans.
So, but it's more than just a gambling den. So the guy behind this is trying to create a sort of a mini Chinese colony 4 hours from the Chinese border. So he's built a sort of Chinatown with noodle bars and noodle shops. There's a monastery which is staffed with monks from Wu Taishan, who he's flown in. And then around the corner, there's the Street of 100 Flowers, which is staffed with imported prostitutes from China. Very friendly they are too, but you know, it's just a little piece of China in Laos, which is, it's one of the more interesting places I went to. Also, when I was leaving, I saw a bunch of excavators flattening land, and I asked why. And I was informed that they're building an international airport to fly in punters from Shanghai and from Kunming. And they have a sort of stable of kind of Hummers, stretched Hummers, and other sort of ludicrous cars. I think there was a Bentley or something. I can't remember. But anyway, it's a place for wealthy Chinese people to go and spend their money.
How does this connect to the broad theme of the book, China's Asian Dream?
Right. Well, the Asian Dream is really a play off the idea of the China Dream or the Chinese Dream, Zhongguo Meng. And it's sort of my interpretation of the way that China's foreign policy is going. And so very, very briefly, I think that, you know, the way China or the Chinese state, Xi Jinping certainly views Chinese history is that, you know, not very long ago, 200, 250 years ago, China was still the great civilization state in Asia. You know, by far the biggest economy, the country that other countries in the region looked up to. And I think there's a sense in which they want to restore that primacy. So, you know, Xi Jinping defined the Chinese dream as the great rejuvenation of the Chinese people. And I think the important word there is fuxing, or rejuvenate, restore. And, you know, under Xi Jinping, China has been pursuing a much more proactive foreign policy, you know, and China is trying to become a genuine sort of global player, if you like. But I think this is really focused in the first place on Asia. And I think, you know, there is this sort of long-term aim for China to be in Asia, really, as the US is in the West, if you like. So to restore its sort of primacy and to be a country that people look up to, and a country that has real economic and sort of leadership clout, if you like.
So there's a couple of things that I want to follow up on here. One is that even though, you know, you've laid it out this way in terms of the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation and couched it in terms of this much talked about Chinese dream or China's dream, well, you don't really go in for the alarmism, what you don't get behind some of the stuff that we're reading about, the recreation of the tribute system. Instead, you kind of lay it out more like, this is what great powers do. And that was distinctly my sense. And when you talked about it in terms of American hegemonism in the Western Hemisphere, I think that's maybe a closer analogy, yeah?
I think that's right. I mean, I do think there are people in China who do look back to the past.
Yeah, sure.
And would like China to have the kind of respect it used to have. You've got to think that sort of back in the good old days when China was the celestial empire, you know, it was ringed by tributary states like Korea, Japan, and Vietnam, and they paid respect to the emperor. And I think there's an element of that in things like the Belt and Road Forum, you know, where Xi Jinping can look like the big man on the global stage, and at Davos as well. So there's an element of that. But of course, you know, rather than talking about history repeating itself or kind of essentialist notions of, you know, sort of China being the middle country and everyone else looking up to it, I think this is more a case of, you know, this is what happens when a country becomes economically strong and wants to become a great power. And it's only natural that China at this stage, I think, in its development, wants to carve out a sphere of influence in Asia.
And we can understand that without resort to some, you know, invoking some psychocultural urge deeply embedded in the Chinese psyche.
Yes, although I do think it is interesting to look at the history. But I don't think, you know, that's a small part of it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Tom, under the rather expansive definition, just about everything you write about could fall under Belt and Road. And, you know, when we're recording this podcast, it's just been about a
couple
fortnight
of weeks
since
now.
The Belt and Road Forum in Beijing, or BAF. So how do you define the Belt and Road for yourself and, you know, for the purposes of the book? Do you include things like the Southeast Asia high-speed rail projects
or
the
your Golden
Triangle special
thing.
Economic
right.
zone that you talk about in the book?
Okay, so I think in the first place, it's worth saying that really it's not definable. You know, it's so broad and it's been deliberately left very open-ended by Beijing. But what I think we can say is that, you know, it does consist of two broad things, and that's where we get the name Belt and Road from. So in the first place, you have the so-called Silk Road Economic Belt, which is about building connectivity in terms of transport links, industrial corridors, fiber optic links, you know, power grids,
gas pipelines,
roads, railways, even sort of agricultural investments, you name it, across the Eurasian continent. Okay, then you have the road, which is helpfully at sea, but Hailu in Chinese, it kind of makes more sense in Chinese, right? But so that's called the 21st century maritime Silk Road, which is really about boosting trade links and building new trade routes through the South China Sea, south into the South Pacific, but particularly west into the Indian Ocean, along the east coast of Africa and into the Mediterranean. Okay, so that's broadly what it means. And sort of within that, there are a few specific projects and sort of transport routes to give you two obvious examples. One that's been in the news a lot recently is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which winds its way from Kashgar in Xinjiang down through the Kunjara Pass on the Pakistani border, and then down to Gwadar, which is a port on the Arabian Sea. Another one is the new Eurasian land bridge, which goes across Xinjiang and through Central Asia, through Kazakhstan, Russia, and into Eastern Europe. And so, you know, we've heard tales of freight trains rumbling their way from Yiwu on the East Coast all the way to London. But I think, you know, it's important not to see this as a sort of list of projects that can be ticked off. And actually, there is no clear plan because it's constantly evolving, right? So the way this will look depends on the vagaries of corporate deal making between SOEs in China, also the government in China, and companies and governments abroad, you know, and that will change. Plans will be made, some will work and some won't. And there's no official map. There isn't even really an official list of countries because they've left it very, very open-ended. You know, there are some numbers that the Ministry of Commerce and NDRC have put out there, but they don't explain exactly what the Belt and Road mean. And I think, you know, almost anything in these countries can be included probably within the Belt and the Road. So frankly, Jeremy, it's very unclear, and I think deliberately so.
Now, you call the Belt and Road arguably the most ambitious development plan ever conceived. So how should our listeners and your readers think about its scale? You said there are numbers. To get a sense of the ambition behind it, is it comparable, as some people have suggested, to the Marshall Plan?
Well, I think it's difficult to make those comparisons. You know, the Marshall Plan was at a certain time in history, and I don't think it's that helpful, actually, to be comparing it to that. You know, we haven't had a big war in Asia. And, you know, Beijing has explicitly said it's not a Marshall Plan.
Right.
So I think let's look at it. Let's look at what it is. And in the first place, yes, it does look very ambitious because it's kind of all-encompassing. And I think rather than getting kind of het up on the name Belt and Road, you know, what it really means is Chinese lending and Chinese development and Chinese engineering firms doing stuff in the developing world. That's really what it means. So, you know, not very clear at all, but, you know, China is doing a lot and there's a lot of
skepticism. And that should have been the same. Doing stuff in the developing world.
Doing stuff in the developing world. You know, there's a lot of skepticism out there. Frankly, a bunch of very irritating old white men who don't really buy any of this and haven't really been anywhere as far as I can see. And I find them annoying because stuff really is happening. You know, China is building a lot. Let me throw some numbers at you. And, you know, all numbers coming out of China should be
taken with a grain of salt.
Absolutely. Right. You've got to be cautious, okay? But, you know, in 2015 to 2016, in that two-year period, MOFCOM, the Ministry of Commerce, says that Chinese firms invested roughly $30 billion in Belt and Road countries. Now, it's quite a lot of money, but if you consider that that's only 10% of China's overall overseas direct investment or outward direct investment during that period, it gives you an idea that it's big, but you know it's not so big. And so that number to me doesn't sound politically inflated. But more importantly, Chinese engineering firms earned revenues of nearly $150 billion in that two-year period. And I think that's what it's more about. It's not so much about Chinese firms taking equity stakes abroad, although they are doing a bit of that. Mm-hmm. It's much more a question of China lending lots of money, mainly through its policy banks, and then Chinese companies, particularly state-owned companies, coming in and building infrastructure.
We'll talk about the role of those policy banks, the Exim Bank and the China Development Bank, in a little bit. But let's talk about the motivations behind the Belt and Road.
Yeah, I mean, Tom, in your book, you talk about three main motivations for the Belt and Road Initiative. Security, where China can weave a network of interdependence and make new friends, as well as hedge against the U.S. alliance structure in Asia. Secondly, economy, where Belt and Road will provide a new source of growth for Chinese domestic industries and a place to absorb overcapacity. And then thirdly, financial, where Belt and Road will bolster the renminbi as a currency for trade settlement. Can we look at each of these and see how compelling the case is?
Yeah, sure. I'll start with the economic one, because I think, you know, first and foremost, this should be seen as an economic policy.
So you've sort of reordered these, and it has been 2 years since you finished your reporting for the book.
I was updating things, but it's been 2 years since I was actually on the ground in these countries, although I'm in China a lot. I was there 2 weeks ago. But we'll start with economics. So in the first place, you know, we all know that China's economy is slowing. Yeah, sure. In the last 18 months or so, cyclically, it's bounced back. You know, it's sunny days in Beijing at the moment. But in terms of, you know, there is climate change occurring in the Chinese economy. So structurally, it is slowing. And they're very keen not only to find new sources of demand outside China, but also to create and nurture new sources of demand. And in a sense, that's what the Belt and the Road is about. It's about taking, you know, China's own domestic development plans, such as, you know, the Go West policy and the Go Out policy, you know, and sort of taking them a little step further, if you like. And so, you know, this is important for, you know, engineering firms and capital goods exporters.
No, it was Vladimir Lenin said that the highest stage of capitalism is Belt and Roadism, yes?
Thanks for that, yeah. But I think, you know, this is important, but it can be exaggerated a little bit because, you know, I don't think the Belt and the Road can save Chinese companies engaged in what we call the old economy, which, you know, they're doing okay at the moment. But, you know, structurally speaking, I think they are going to struggle. And I mean, to give you an idea of the numbers involved, you know, I reckon by having looked at the kind of available financing, and this is a very rough guesstimate, and actually I say, but really this was my colleague Arthur Kroeber who came up with this number. You know, he reckons that China can probably finance something in the region of maybe up to $100 billion a year along the Belt and the Road. But in 2015, China was investing more than $150 billion a year at home per month.
Wow.
Right. So that gives you an idea of just how much investment there is in China. So, you know, I think anything that happens abroad can be helpful, but it's not going to kind of solve the problem of overcapacity in China.
Right.
So anyway, that's one thing. But I think another important economic aspect of this is developing underdeveloped or poorer parts of the Chinese mainland as well. So places like Yunnan and Xinjiang, you know, Guangxi, Heilongjiang, Inner Mongolia, sort of places which are landlocked often on China's borders. You know, if you take Yunnan, it's, you know, it's the equivalent of Romania within the EU. It's the second poorest province in China. And, you know, what they're trying to do is to build new trade routes so that people in Yunnan can trade with their neighbors and they can develop economically.
Right.
So there's an aspect of that too. Another thing,
greater Mekong region.
That's right, yes. I mean, another thing is that China's trying to export standards abroad too. So technology. So things like, you know, high-speed rail standards, telecoms networks. So for example, you know, Huawei and ZTE are very active across Asia. You know, they're going to be rolling out 5G networks. So, you know, they will want other countries to adopt Chinese standards if they can. Pipelines and other things too. So that's certainly a part of it. But I think there's also a way in which the economic aims kind of seep into the security aims too, and particularly in Xinjiang, where, you know, China is rightly or wrongly, Beijing is very worried about sort of militant Islam terrorism.
Before we get to security, there is one more thing in sort of the economics of this that I want to ask you about. One is there really any expectation of repayment from, especially from some of the poor developing countries to which China is making enormous loans?
Right. Well, I think it depends on the individual country. I mean, clearly, a lot of these loans are not genuinely made on a commercial basis, right? So, and China, you know, I heard somebody told me that they gave me an estimate that within Beijing, you know, they reckon that they may lose up to 80% of the money in Pakistan, sort of 50%, I think, in Central Asia and 30% in Burma. It might have been the other way around. I can't remember exactly. But the point is, and these numbers are, again, they're guesstimates. But the point is that, you know, there's a recognition in Beijing that, you know, this is to a certain extent about spending money for strategic reasons.
Yeah, India hears this and gets very nervous.
Yes, right. So India looks at the numbers and thinks, you know, there's going to be no economic payback. You know, that's an exaggeration. There will be, but in some places there won't be. And they think, well, if it's not commercial, then clearly it is strategic. This isn't about win-win sort of economic diplomacy. You know, in fact, this is a
security play,
a smokescreen for strategic control, if you like.
And so, again, before we get to security, one more question for you about economics is we've all read Deborah Brodigam's book about Chinese investment in Africa. She makes the comparison to what Japan did in China during the 1970s, which was these big infrastructure for resources deals. And China's done the same thing in Africa. Are a lot of these deals that they're doing in Central Asia and parts of Africa as well, are they sort of along that same vein? We'll build you the port and the mine, you give us the copper, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it can work out like that. I mean, I think normally, you know, they want money back. But, you know, there's always, if you're a poor country like Laos and China's building a 7.2 billion railway through Laos and it's being financed out of China, you know, in the end, will they be able to pay back what is the equivalent of 2/3 of their GDP, in cash? So yes, it could become a conveyor belt for exporting resources. And of course, the reason why China, or one of the major reasons why China is investing in somewhere like Kazakhstan, is that it has oil. So of course, there is a big element of wanting resources as a part of this, but it's not the only element.
Okay, so let's move to security. I mean, so China has, of course, been part of this SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which has been in large part about, beating
the three evils.
The three evils, right? Terrorism and separatism and religious extremism. But this whole Belt and Road Initiative, this gets compared to the Marshall Plan a lot, like we were saying. Beijing, as you say, doesn't, and it insists that it isn't like that because it isn't about Cold War alliance structures and things like that, right? It isn't supposed to be a counterweight to America and its regional allies, but isn't it?
Well, I think it might work out like that in the end. I think that when you're investing a lot and lending a lot of money, it gives you economic leverage. And I think that will translate to a lesser or greater extent in different countries into geopolitical leverage. And you mentioned Central Asia, and I think that's an interesting place for this. So, if you look back 25 years now or so, with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Central Asia had been a part of Russia's backyard. And then, for 10 years, it was kind of left on its own. But then sort of starting in the early 2000s, China realized there was a lot of resources there, whether it was oil or gas or uranium, lots of stuff there that it wanted. And China moved in very, very quickly and is now very much economic top dog in the region. Now, it tries very hard not to step on Russia's toes because Russia is still the major military and political power in the region. And China is always willing to work with the Russians if they can thwart kind of Western power, if you like. Putin and Xi Jinping pretend to be friends. But I think, truly they're kind of frenemies and there's not much trust between Russia and China. And, if Russia ever thought that Chinese influence was sort of turning not only from sort of an economic influence into something more political, I think, that relationship could become a lot more fraught. But I think in time, it's almost inevitable. This is what happens when you're a great power. And, one thing that China's going to realize is that if you have assets abroad, if things go wrong, you may have to protect those assets. This is one of the reasons why the US is active across the world. And if you're going to be a great power, it brings with it great responsibility and sort of unforeseen consequences.
Speaking of which, Spider-Man.
I didn't know. Wow. Okay.
I've been editing the subchina.com daily newsletter half a year now. And so every day I have to scan in detail the news about China. And one of the things that I've tried to do is to look at things that somehow don't get a great deal of coverage in the MSM, the mainstream media, the kind of Anglophone media. And one regularly recurring type of news is unrest along the Belt and Road, basically. Just in the last week, there's been a kidnapping of two Chinese teachers in Pakistan. You have riots in India against Chinese mobile phone companies, in Bangladesh against, a Chinese industrial zone, in Myanmar against a dam, in Pakistan and Baluchistan, there's a kind of Baluchistan independence movement that is decided that the China-Pakistan economic corridor is not in their interests and are, organizing demonstrations.
Right. And Gwadar port is actually in Baluchistan, just in case anyone's wondering.
Yeah. So how do you think China is going to deal with the fact that you know, the Belt and Road projects, or even just the fact, you know, if you don't call it Belt and Road, just the fact that China is becoming a globalized economy with interests all over the world, it's going to be drawn into local conflicts. It's going to be perceived as an economic, if not military, hegemon. How do you think China will respond to this?
I mean, clearly, this is one of the big problems that China has to face. And as you say, you know, there's already been a lot of pushback in countries, particularly where you have the political winds kind of shift. You know, one of the problems China's had is that Chinese SOEs and, you know, the Chinese government, they're very happy whining and dining people who are very like them. So, you know, sort of various leaders in Central Asia, Rajapaksa, the former leader in Sri Lanka. And then when you have countries where there are elections, or, you know, in Burma, you had the military junta that dissolved itself and suddenly people had a voice, then you do get this pushback. And it's something that China's going to have to learn to deal with. And in a sense, it's not only a Chinese problem. You know, this is something that other countries have also had to learn about. And I think, you know, it's worth emphasizing that, you know, this is not unique to China. Its companies are often, you know, they don't have that much experience yet. Some are more experienced than others. So, for example, if you look at Indonesia, China's building a high-speed rail line between Jakarta and Bandung. And they've actually brought in Sinohydro to help out on that, even though it's not a dam, you know, just simply because they have experience of working in the country and they know how to speak to people there. Yeah. And that's something that Chinese companies have to get better at. If you look at Burma, you know, you mentioned the Myitsone Dam, which was this $3-something billion dam that was postponed sort of 6 years ago now, and it remains postponed because of protests against it.
But hundreds of millions of yen were spent. And
Yeah, they were. But then at China Power International, the company that did it, you know, I was speaking to someone, an ex-British diplomat who's based there, and she was saying that actually, you know, that they're doing a much better job now, and their sort of CSR policy, whatever you want to call it, is quite sophisticated now. Mm. So, you know, companies, enterprises will learn, and they will have to learn, but of course there will be big problems along the way. And, you know, I think Beijing is well aware of that. But, you know, I don't think we can downplay those problems. I think Pakistan is going to be the most difficult place of all. You know, in the Pakistani government is employing, you know, you hear different numbers, 12, 14, 15,000 troops or sort of security officers to try to protect Chinese workers in the region. But, you know, it's a very unstable environment. And, you know, China's been working in Pakistan for years. And, you know, even 10, 15 years ago, you had rebels firing rockets at the hotel in Gwadar, where there were various engineers staying. So, you know, this is going to be a problem. If you look at the Baloch, you know, they're very like the Uyghurs, to be honest. You know, they want sort of independence in their land, and they have a big problem with the government in Islamabad. And so, you know, if they attack the big Chinese project in Pakistan, in a way, it's a way of attacking the state. So, you know, China will be drawn into kind of conflicts beyond its control. So, yeah, it's very, very complex indeed.
Well, I mean, China has stepped up its contributions to UN peacekeeping efforts. It's less afraid of late to actually, you know, exercise military force in the rest of the world. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. We did have one topic that we didn't touch on yet, which was, you said there was sort of a third leg of the reasons, and that was finance. But this is something that isn't quite as important anymore. The idea that the RMB will be used as a currency for settlement on a lot of these trade deals, they've sort of backburned this, as we were saying, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back a few years ago, internationalization of the RMB was a big topic.
Right.
And I think long-term, nothing's changed. You know, China would like its currency to be sort of akin to a Deutschmark or a kind of euro across Asia in time, right? This is all a part of the kind of scheme for China to be great again, if you like to put it into Trumpian terms, which is what Xi Jinping is trying to do. And so that, you know, so that long-term goal is still there. But I think right now it's been put on the back burner for a little bit. You know, this is related to fears about capital outflows in right. China. You know, they've been stemmed for the moment. But at the moment, it's all about sort of protecting the value of the RMB. So, you know, they don't want to open the capital account any more than they need to. So, yeah, it's a long-term plan. But at the moment, you know, if you look at the loans across the region, they're basically all in dollars at the moment.
Right. So I want to talk about some of the institutions that China has created, which some have suggested are meant to, certainly to supplement, but possibly to supplant the old Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank and the IMF. Let's start with the AIIB, which, of course, is you describe this as kind of a third way between membership in broad multinational organizations where China lacks kind of sufficient power and bilateral relations.
Yeah, so. I think I might say first, when it comes to supplanting Bretton Woods, I think I might have been the first person to write that. And I think, you know, I might have exaggerated a little bit for effect. So, you know, I mean, the way I see the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank is sort of China's attempt to complement or supplement the existing global architecture rather than to rewrite it, if you like. Because I don't think China's in a position to do that yet.
No, certainly not.
But it's you know, it's very helpful for China to work with other countries, you know, in a sort of multilateral organization, because, you know, one of the big problems with the Belt and the Road and sort of China's infrastructure diplomacy in general is that it's simply not trusted. So China talks about win-win sort of mutual benefits, but other countries, a lot of countries see it more as a double win to China, right? And so, you know, that's what happens if China's working on a bilateral basis. But if it can work on a multilateral basis, you know, sort of with other countries, in other words, then it suddenly it looks a lot less scary.
Let's talk about how this happened with the AIIB. There was this initial pushback against it led by the Obama administration, which everyone basically is in unanimous agreement was a bad mistake. But the effect of actually bringing in many of these developed Western countries like Britain and Germany as founding members of the AIIB has meant better governance, has meant China is merely sort of primus inter pares as one of the founding members, maybe the one that's putting up a large proportion of the initial funding, but they're not making all the loan decisions.
No, and I mean, so I think the bank, or the Chinese bank, as it was originally called by people at the Asian Development Bank, who are very scared about this.
Right.
You know, it's going to be very, very responsible. It's going to do everything right. You know, the bank is full of ex world bankers and people in the ADB, British diplomats, etc. And you know, I don't think China or Beijing ever thought it would attract so many members from the developed world.
Right.
So, you know, they are literally stakeholders in the bank and have a say in how it operates. And actually, the bank has dissociated itself from the Belt and the Road. You know, it was originally conceived as a financing vehicle for Chinese infrastructure diplomacy.
But it's what? It's $2 billion
a
year.
Right. So, I mean, but so these days it's kind of separate. And also, you know, it's symbolically important because it shows that China now is willing to go out there and try to sort of mold the global architecture, that it wants to be a leader, okay? But in terms of the Belt and the Road, it's kind of irrelevant, you know. So Junito and the man in charge of the bank, you know, says that it won't lend more than $2 billion a year for the first 5 years. Now, you know, if we're talking about in the region of up to China financing investments of $100 billion, you know, that is peanuts. So most of the financing for these projects will come from China's policy banks. So that's China Development Bank and China Exim Bank.
Can you tell us about those, Tom? Actually,
yeah, we did say that we were going to get to that. So yeah, talk about the role of the Exim Bank.
Right. So, you know, I think to give a little bit of kind of context for this, you know, China wants to be a leader in the region. And you know, what does China have? Well, it has enormous economic heft. And that economic heft really comes through its banks. You know, China has a population of 1.4 billion people, you know, and they save a lot of money. Also, of course, it has a large current account surplus, too. So it has its forex reserves. So there's lots of money there. OK, but so how do you get that money out of the economy into these other countries? Well, you know, you can do it through the commercial banks. But of course, you know, they are meant to be vaguely commercial. Now, we all know that China's banking system, you know, has problems. But still, you know, those banks do want to make a kind of economic return. But China has policy banks, which are there to do the bidding of the government, if you like. Now, of course, they don't want to lose pots of money, too, although they have done in places like Venezuela. but, you know, they are policy banks. So they are there to deliver government policy. And, you know, this is government policy. And I've spoken about the economic rationale for doing this. But there is a big strategic rationale too, and so, you know, those strategic investments will largely be funded through China's policy banks.
How well capitalized are these banks? What are we talking about here?
Well, their finances are kind of murky, but you know, they lend every year far more than the World Bank and the ADB put together. So that gives you an idea of how large they are.
Right,
we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars.
Astonishing.
And you say they lend already. Who are the recipients of these loans?
Right. So the recipients are governments and companies abroad. I think a good example to look at here is Sri Lanka, which, you know, until January 2015 was under the leadership of a very unpleasant man, you know, really a kind of murderous dictator in many respects, a guy called Mahinda Rajapaksa. But Chinese companies, Chinese state-owned enterprises, worked very closely with his government. And, you know, over a sort of 5 or 10 year period, the numbers again are not very clear, but, you know, they lent in the region of $5 billion. And they lent at crazy interest rates. So, you know, China is often seen as lending at sort of below commercial value with no strings attached loans. But actually, it was quite the opposite in Sri Lanka. So I interviewed the Minister of Finance there, a big kind of barrel-chested man, who told me that China, in some cases, was lending at 8.8%, which is really very, very high indeed.
Why on earth would they turn to China then for such high interest loans? I mean, was it just a lack of available credit from other lenders?
Well, yes. In the first place, nobody else wanted to lend to this nasty regime. But, you know, the reason that China was lending at that rate was that it was siphoning off a lot of that money into the pockets of Rajapaksa and his cronies. And this is something that the government there told me explicitly. And so they said, you know, China was doing all these corrupt deals, essentially, with the previous government. They said it wasn't China's fault. They had to work with the government. So they were being diplomatic in their language. But they said that now we have a new government in place. We have to renegotiate and restructure all of those loans. They have to take a haircut on their debt, blah, blah, blah. And to some extent, that has happened. But they also said that we don't have to only accept Chinese money. We can look to the Americans, the Europeans, the Japanese, the World Bank, the ADB, all these other places, India. In the event, though, not much money came in from these other countries, right. And Sri Lanka had to go to the IMF to get bailed out. And then a year on, you know, various sort of postponed projects, Chinese projects in Sri Lanka are back on course. You know, Sri Lanka's begun swapping debt for equity in, say, for example, Hambantota Port in the south of the island. And actually, you know, China's position there is as strong as ever. And during the election in 2015, China's grip on the country became an election issue. It wasn't so much an issue among the ordinary people, but if you looked at the manifesto of the incoming government, you know, they spoke about being colonized by the white man, and they very much implied there was a new colonizer. They didn't actually say the yellow man, but, you know, that's what they were implying, that there was a new colonizer on the horizon.
Of course, Sri Lankans who were opposed to the old regime and are worried about China aren't the only people in the region worried about China building, for example, a very, very large port in Sri Lanka. It's probably the biggest, brightest, and closest pearl in the so-called string of pearls that India worries so much about. Talk a little bit about Indian concerns over what China is doing, especially in the Indian Ocean.
Right. So, I think India has two concerns. In the first place, and I think this is the biggest concern, is the idea that China is building a string of pearls around the neck of Mother India, if you like. So, you know, China has ports in Colombo and Hambantota in Sri Lanka. There's Gwadar Port in the Arabian Sea in Pakistan. You know, it has an interest in Karachi Port as well. There's a port at Chokpu on Madei Island in the Bay of Bengal, which is on the Burmese coast. You know, there are other interests in places like Bangladesh as well. And, you know, China's always looking for new ports. Now, I think, you know, most of these ports are actually, you know, commercial. So, for example, the Colombo South Container Terminal, which I visited, it's owned by China Merchants, which is a Hong Kong listed company. Yeah, it's, you know, sure, its mother company is a Beijing SOE. But, you know, this is a commercial port. In fact, it's probably the best port, certainly from sort of in South India. You know, it's possibly the best port, actually. Certainly in the Indian Ocean, it has the biggest gantry cranes in the world, along with Shanghai, to give you an idea. And, you know, it can very, very large vessels can dock there. At the same time, a couple of years ago, a Chinese nuclear-powered sub, a PLA naval vessel, did dock there for water and food. But the Indians got very nervous about this because, you know, they reckon that, you know, these ports may be ostensibly commercial, but if they have a dual purpose, if they can be used in the event of a war or, you know, for military purposes or for kind of listening in, you know, in the region, that does worry them. And, you know, they do believe that China has long-term ambitions to push its navy into the Indian Ocean. Clearly, that's true. At the same time, though, I do think India exaggerates the threats. You know, China is nowhere near being able to be a genuine presence in the Indian Ocean. It's decades off. And I think it's also a very useful way for the Indian military to try to get more cash out of New Delhi. You know, that's what, you know, armies need, if you like. So I think it's kind of overplayed. And, you know, China will always struggle to be a big presence in the Indian Ocean. You know, it's sort of it's Indian territory, if you like. It's India's backyard, and they will always be bigger there. But there is another concern, too, which has been in the press a lot recently, and that's the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which in the north does run through Kashmir. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of part of Kashmir that India claims as its sovereign territory. So, you know, it does talk about sovereignty issues. I think there's a bit of an exaggeration here again, because, you know, Kashmir is an old problem. You know, it dates back to partition back in 1947. You know, this is an old problem and nothing's really changed. But anything that kind of sort of cements, you know, that region as sort of Pakistani territory, if you like, you know, is something that they're going to complain about. But, you know, there's already been a road there. You know, the road through the Kunjarab Pass, which crosses over into China, was built in the 1970s and 80s. You know, so this isn't a new
problem. It's also not the first time that there's been a major transport route through parts of Kashmir that India claims. For example, you know, the road that links Lhasa and Urumqi runs straight through
I mean, this is an old problem.
Right. Interesting.
You wrote your book before the global disaster that we like to call the Trump clownship. What's changed since Trump became president of the U.S.?
Yeah, so I mean, I did write sort of 99% of the book before Trump was elected. You know, I did manage to make a couple tiny changes in November of last year, just before it came out. It was kind of irritating. But fundamentally, it hasn't changed the picture for what China's doing, except to make China's position stronger than it was. And I think TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is a very important element to this. So, you know, this was a mega trade deal led by the US, encompassing a handful of countries in Asia, including Japan, and some countries in the Americas. But, you know, the US at the time very much saw this in geopolitical terms.
And Ash Carter, didn't he say the TPP is worth an aircraft carrier?
That's right. So Ash Carter, the Secretary of Defense,
right, that's right,
at the time said that it was worth an extra aircraft carrier to him. So, you know, that's explicitly saying this was a geopolitical ploy, if you like. It was a way that America could kind of recommit to the region. And, you know, of course, it has a strong alliance structure in the region, but it has to, you know, you have to water your crops, if you like. You have to show people that you still care, you want to be a leader. And that's very much what TPP was doing. Now, you know, during the leadership campaign, and Trump, you know, sort of spoke about possibly withdrawing U.S. troops from South Korea, from Japan, and, you know, sort of said that those countries should get their own nuclear deterrent. You know, since he came into power, his administration has gone some way to recommitting to the region, but it certainly hasn't shown himself to be a kind of reliable partner. So I think militarily, you know, the U.S. is still top dog in the region. You know, it does have military alliances with Korea, with Japan, with the Philippines, with Australia, you know, and it's getting closer to India, to Vietnam. And so, you know, if you're China, you do look out and you see yourself ringed by enemies, if you like. And I think it's important to kind of realize that, because people forget. So militarily, at least, you know, the US is still the leading power. But I think in terms of economic leadership, China is in a much stronger position now than it was a few years ago. So, you know, Trump withdrew from the TPP. In its place, the only other big mega trade deal on the table RCEP. Is the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, RCEP. Now, this is very different because RCEP includes the 10 ASEAN countries. So that also adds Indonesia, which is a big economy, into the mix. But also the 6 countries with which ASEAN has free trade agreements, which includes China, which wasn't in TPP,
right,
and Korea. And this
Japan.
Is a big deal. I mean, Japan was in TPP, but, you know, Japan, now that TPP is dead, it is now pushing much harder for RCEP. And, you know, this is in terms of regional integration, this is much more of a sort of Asian. It's much more of an Asian
It's not Chile
deal,
and Peru.
Rather than Asian Pacific.
Right.
And it's important because, you know, China's economy makes up about half the GDP of the RCEP countries. And so although officially RCEP is led by the ASEAN nations, which is useful for China because it's multilateral, it doesn't look like China sort of making all the decisions. Inevitably, China being by far the most powerful economy in RCEP, it'll have a big say, right? So if you're China, you're using the Belt and Road to try to integrate Asia in terms of on the ground infrastructure. This now is another institution by which, you know, you can help to integrate Asia, you know, with this kind of aim of, you know, what I call China's Asian dream, which is for China to be, you know, the economic leader of the region. And that also has a geopolitical impact. So, you know, Trump has shot himself in the foot, frankly. It's a very, very foolish policy.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Clinton planned on pulling out of TPP as well.
She did. Equally foolish.
Right. Equally foolish. So let's, I mean, since we're on the subject of American responses to this, Jeremy and I had the terrific opportunity to interview Joe Nye, who is a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School and probably best known for this concept of soft power, which he both coined and defined. But we talked about that, of course, about Chinese soft power opportunities in the age of Trump. But we also talked about the well-known Thucydides trap. And a trap that he actually is more concerned about, which he calls the Kindleberger trap. It's named for Charlie Kindleberger, who's an MIT historian of economics and a principal architect of the Marshall Plan. We weren't really talking about the Marshall Plan, but I mean, his idea, just in a nutshell, is that the disasters of the 1930s, the Depression and what followed, rise of fascism, even the Holocaust, all really resulted from America as the rising power in the world after the decline of the UK after the Great War, its failure to provide public goods in the world, that it wasn't providing the stable currency that the UK no longer could. It wasn't, you know, part of multinational organizations. We failed to ratify, I mean, to even join the League of Nations and pass the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, right? And, you know, I mean, I got to thinking, we didn't really discuss this in any depth, but I got to thinking about this and wondered whether we might see the Belt and Road Initiative as China's provision of public goods. I mean, to what extent can we see these as public goods?
Right. Well, I think in the first place, you know, China says everything it's doing is mutually beneficial and good for everyone else. But of course, you know, what China is doing is in the first place for China's own good. You know, it is self-motivated.
Totally natural.
And of course,
right,
it is, you know, every country, frankly, foreign policy ought to be self-motivated, all right? At the same time, though, I think it is worth pointing out that China can certainly help provide useful development or public goods, if you like, to poor countries that have little sort of financing capability
or engineering capacity
yeah, themselves, all right? So if, for example, you're Tajikistan, if you're Kyrgyzstan, if you're Laos, you know, these small fragile states, China can come in and build what you need. So for example, in Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, you know, China has built the power grid, and it's also built a spur from its gas pipeline from Turkmenistan through those countries. So it's providing power to them as well.
Literally so, keeping the lights
on. Yeah, so I'd say literally keeping the lights on, okay? And, you know, so if you're a leader of those countries, that's very helpful, and it means you can provide public goods which you couldn't otherwise provide. So perhaps that actually keeps them in power. So it's, you know, it's also useful politically, and that does give China political leverage in those countries as well. And it's true that, you know, so that China can bring big benefits through its infrastructure. Equally, you know, if this is not carried out in a sensible manner, it can also bring much harm as well. So like an obvious example is dams. You know, you can bring electricity as much needed, but, you know, if you're damming people's land and you're not compensating them, then, you know, there will be a lot of pushback against that too. So, you know, I think that it's not wrong when Beijing, you know, sort of presents this as a development plan. You know, it really is. But equally, you know, some people talk about one belt, one trap. So, you know, if you're a country that takes on too much debt, you may struggle to pay it back.
Right. Djibouti, for example.
For example, yeah. Actually, there's also another meaning of one belt, one trap. And this is something that Jörg Fuchs, who's the chairman of the European Chamber of Commerce in Beijing, likes to talk about. He's one of the most experienced foreign businessmen in China. And, you know, he speaks often to very senior executives in SOEs. And, you know, there are plenty of Chinese executives and also in the policy banks and commercial banks too, particularly, who are worried about the political pressure that's been put on them to lend and do business in countries where they're not going to make any money. So it's also a debt trap for them as well.
But there are real things happening here, as you point out. It's not just fakery. But how would you characterize the response of the American punditry to this? I mean, it strikes me as fairly cynical.
Right. I think the punditry across America, and actually even more so in Europe, because Europe is sort of officially on the belt and the road, if you like, has been very, very cynical indeed. And, you know, I think it's right to be skeptical. And, you know, there is a lot of kind of puffery involved in this. You know, the Belt and Road Forum was a big PR push, if you like. And, you know, a lot of Beijing's plans are not very well defined. And, you know, there have been lots of instances in the past of Chinese investments going wrong. And so, you know, as I say, we should be skeptical. At the same time, though, there is real stuff happening. Whether it brings a commercial return or not will depend on the individual project. But it is a fact that, you know, last year, 1,700 trains made the journey across Central Asia from China to Europe. Okay. Now, is this meaningful in terms of China's global trade? No, not yet. But is it meaningful to some of those countries? Yes, it is. You know, China is now exporting directly, for example, to Afghanistan, Iran, through its trains. It is building a new railway through Laos. You know, Laos has almost no infrastructure at all to speak of at the moment. If you go to Cambodia, you know, one in three roads in that country have been built by Chinese money. You know, there's one lovely thing if you go to Phnom Penh. There's a bridge that crosses the Mekong River there, which was built 20 or 30 years ago by the Japanese, because, you know, Japan was there before China. What China's doing is not entirely new. And actually, you know, I talk about a sort of infrastructure arms race in the region between Japan and China. Mm-hmm. But so if you look at that old bridge, sort of literally 200 or 300 yards parallel with it, there's a brand new, bigger, shinier Chinese built bridge, right? So, but the point is that, you know, China is really building useful infrastructure. It's not all a waste of money. And you have to realize that. I think a lot of the skepticism comes from people, sort of analysts, looking at this from 30,000 feet who never get off their butts and go anywhere.
Some of it reminds me a little of, you know, the skepticism you saw around domestic Chinese infrastructure projects. I mean, I remember people scoffing at the idea of the Fifth Ring Road in Beijing as, you know, a kind of white elephant, you know, boondoggle when there were farmlands, you know, right around it. Whereas now the Fifth Ring Road is, you know, doesn't move because of traffic jams. And, you know, they're building the Seventh Ring Road and thinking about the Eighth.
Yeah, no, I think what China's doing, and this is actually why people are so skeptical, is that really it's taking its own development model, which is debt-fueled and sort of very high investment, and shifting it overseas. And so the people who are always bearish about that model of development in China will feel the same way about this overseas. And, you know, there was a big row back in, it would have been sort of 6 or 7 years ago now, about high-speed rail in China. So people saw this as being a massive waste of money. You know, why was it building expensive high-speed rail rather than building conventional rail? And those people who were critics then are still critics now, frankly. They think that the financial return on high-speed rail hasn't been worth it, whereas, you know, any sane person, I think, who takes high-speed rail in China thinks that it's been magnificent.
Right.
But that's probably, you know, that reflects my own personal biases. But I think it's very similar for these projects abroad. You know, the way Beijing views economics is not the same way as Western bankers view it. It's not about getting financial returns. There are other returns it's looking for too: returns of development, returns of economic opportunity.
But don't you think one of the interesting aspects to this push abroad for the Chinese development model, if you will, is that, you know, in China, if you want to build a high-speed rail, you can move all the peasant farmers from their land who are in the way of the high-speed rail. You can marshal a huge labor force of people willing to work for a rather low salary. You can sort of make it happen by fiat. Whereas in Pakistan or Myanmar, you might not find the locals so receptive to having a dam or a high-speed rail project built across their land. You might not find the workers as willing to work their butts off, you know, 7 days a week for a pittance. You're going to find a lot more obstacles to creating these massive infrastructure projects.
And to be honest, I mean, China has not had a great track record of diplomatic sensitivity or sort of political finesse when it comes to things like this, right?
No, I think that's all true. And, you know, I can point to an example at the moment. If you look at Indonesia and the high-speed rail there, it's been constantly delayed because, you know, it's very difficult to buy up land and get people off their land. And so, yes, this is a problem. I mean, another thing that China has that other countries don't, except for India, which isn't really a part of this at the moment, is that it has lots of people. And so, you know, you can build stuff in China and people will come eventually because of the population pressures. You know, that won't be the case in somewhere like Central Asia, which is a big open space. And so, you know, China does have to, I keep on saying China or Beijing, you know, often these decisions are made by enterprises.
Right.
But, you know, it is something it has to think about. So the model can't be exactly the same. But, you know, I think the kind of the broad way they think about it is pretty ingrained in the kind of psyche in Beijing.
I'm reminded of this beautiful quote from your last book, I believe it was, where you talked about white elephants and how the Chinese metabolism is sort of fast enough to digest a few white elephants. Yeah,
absolutely. Yes. And also the fact that it doesn't, you know, when China was growing fast, it didn't matter actually if it had a few white elephants. Yeah. But I mean, of course, you know, if you have a very large white elephant in a small country, then actually that can matter enormously.
Right. I mean, unless you import Chinese enzymes to digest the thing.
Yeah. One thing, Jeremy, to go back to your previous question about, you know, sort of workers, you know, in the kind of smaller states, China can import a lot of workers, you know, and it's doing that in places like Kyrgyzstan and Laos. The countries where they have a stronger government, somewhere like Kazakhstan with more money, you know, they don't let in Chinese workers unless they're sort of managers and engineers, sort of engineering foremen, if you like. But, you know, there are enough Chinese workers who can be persuaded to go abroad and work for pittance, as they do across Africa as well.
That's right. Tom, man, it was absolutely great to have you here in North Carolina. I trust you enjoyed the barbecue.
Thanks. Great pleasure. Fantastic barbecue, and I'll be back.
Yeah, and please do come back. And join us for a recommendation for our listeners, won't you?
Yeah, sure.
So before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at subchina.com. You can follow SubChina on Twitter at SubChinaNews and on Facebook at facebook.com/SubChinaNews. If you like the Seneca podcast, by all means, go leave us a positive review on the Apple iTunes Store or on Google Play or wherever it is that you go to review apps. This really helps, and it means a lot to us, too. So on to recommendations. Jeremy, as long as you can quiet that child down, you can begin.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have a BBC moment here. I have two children who have invaded my home studio. So I'd like to recommend, it's called Ear to Asia. It's a podcast from Viola. Keep quiet. It's a podcast from the Asia Institute at the University of Melbourne. And they interview people who know stuff about Asia, you know, academics mostly, but really interesting, you know, from China. Sorry, I really, these children. you know, from folk music, like work songs in Sichuan, to Indonesia's education system, a great range of expertise. It's called Ear to Asia.
Yeah, it's a very good podcast, yeah. So you had one episode in particular you wanted to recommend, right?
Yeah, there's one with Professor Anne McLaren about her work into the folk ecology, as she calls it, of the Lower Yangtze Delta, you know, which includes these very long song cycles sung by people, you know, working mostly. And very interesting.
Those are on the actual recording too, so make sure to.
Yeah, it includes a few songs.
Great recommendation. It's an excellent podcast. Tom, what do you have for us?
I have an autobiography to recommend by Xiaolu Guo or Guo Xiaolu. So she is a very, very interesting woman who was brought up in a dirt poor fishing village on the Zhejiang-Fujian border. But
an island, some little
shitty
island.
It was just on the coast. And then she made her way to the Beijing Film Academy and then got a scholarship to the UK and lived in London. And it's about her kind of her way up in life. But it's a fascinating book. But I think what's most interesting really is a novel she read a couple of years ago, which is sort of semi-autobiographical, and it's based on her experiences, and it's called A Concise Chinese English Dictionary for Lovers. And
it's a great title.
It's a great title. So the kind of conceit of the book is that you have a new Chinese immigrant in a strange foreign country who learns English by writing a book. Okay, so the book starts off with sort of Chinese syntax written in English, and she's looking at London through the eyes of a foreigner. And you know, there are some very kind of funny phrases in it. I mean, if you speak Chinese, so for example, you know, she's looking for Big Ben, you know, the clock, and she says, "Where's that big silly clock?" Which is what
big
it's called, which is what it's called in Chinese, for example. But as the book goes on, the syntax improves and her English improves. But it's just it's a fascinating way of seeing my own country afresh, and I'd thoroughly recommend it.
Oh yeah. We all know her, right? Or even
I don't know her, but I believe you do. Or did
Jeremy? You know her, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, great recommendation. I need to get to that.
Oh, sorry. I should give the name of the book. Actually, the autobiography.
Right. Which is called.
right? It's called, it has different names, I think, in the UK and the US. In the UK, it's called Once Upon a Time in the East. In the US, I believe it's called Nine Continents.
Interesting. Jojo. Yeah.
Good.
Both good names. Yeah. I am going to recommend a Swedish folk trio called Vasin, which is composed of a guitarist, a violist, and most importantly, a masterful player of the nickel harpa. Have you heard of the nickel harpa? For some reason, is very popular these days. I keep seeing, you know, people passing around YouTube videos of people who
is that play, as cool as the matotin?
It's no. Cooler in a way. So it's a kind of keyed fiddle. So you play it with a bow. It sounds sort of like a shimmering, crazily bright violin. It's really full throated, and it
sounds like a matotin.
Yeah, but. It's actually keyed. That is, you depress keys, which act as the frets, so it's. I don't know how you do a vibrato on it. They somehow are able to, but it sounds terrific. Vasin, this band sounds vaguely Celtic, a bit like Appalachian folk music. Jeremy, I think you'd really dig it. But they actually have a really different rhythmic sense. It's quite progressive in that. I mean, I listen to a lot of Swedish metal bands, and I sort of see now where their indigenous folk influences come from. It's very cool. Weird time signatures and starts and stops. Anyway, I downloaded a bunch of the stuff on Spotify. I've been listening to them basically nonstop. It's great music. Great music. Thanks to Jim Millward for turning me on to them. Anyway, hey, Tom, once again, thanks so much, man. Get out there and read Tom's book. I swear, it's incredibly edifying. It's more timely than ever. I mean, if you really want to understand China's developmental ambitions in Asia, this is the book to read.
Could I give you the full title as well of the name?
Yeah.
So the full name is China's Asian Dream, Empire Building Along the New Silk Road.
Right. Although, you know, use the word empire once in the whole book, right? And it's in quotes.
I was very careful because, you know, I don't think that China is genuinely building a sort of, you know, an old-fashioned empire. But
you saw copy this way.
Yeah, but in terms of, you know, what it's trying to do is to build a trade, an investment nexus lubricated by Chinese cash. And it's trying to push its economic leverage and create kind of mutual dependencies. And I think we can talk about a sort of informal economic empire, if you like.
Yeah, very, very good. So yeah, definitely go out and check out the book. I mean, I read it months ago. I'm probably going to read it again. It's very good. Jeremy, as always, very good to talk to you.
Likewise.
Love to your beautiful children. The Cynical Podcast is powered by SubChina and it's produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Thanks also to Enla Cheng and to Sarai Darabi from SubChina. Drop us an email at cynica@subchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/cynicapodcast and follow us on Twitter @cynicapodcast. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.